It is Thursday, November 12th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, we look at new efforts to try to end Syria's civil war. Amnesty International says Chinese police are using torture to extract confessions. We'll hear from a Hong Kong-based researcher.
What we find out is that to those people, especially dissidents, human rights defenders, Falun Gong petitioners, religious believers, and even like corrupt officials, they can also be subject to torture when they're detained.
And a new documentary looks at the life of Real Madrid star Cristiano Ronaldo. It's all ahead. A second round of international talks is scheduled in Vienna Saturday on ways to end the nearly five-year Syrian civil war. A key item is expected to be how to decide which opposition groups Damascus is willing to negotiate. In a communique following last month's first round, the 17 world powers, the UN and the EU, agreed on the importance of accelerating diplomatic efforts to end the conflict and a UN-led effort to reach a ceasefire. Regional analyst David Lesh of Trinity University in Texas tells VOA's Victor Beatty, while the future of President Bashar al-Assad also remains a key obstacle to peace, the opposition remains fragmented.
And finding a so-called acceptable opposition, certainly to the Syrian government and its supporters, Iran and Russia, any of those that have been deemed as terrorists, which is almost anybody fighting the Syrian government, are deemed as unacceptable. What's interesting is that many of those are also deemed unacceptable by a number of countries in the West, including the United States, such as Ahrar al-Sham, which many would say is a radical Islamist group that is kind of a homegrown version of Jabhat al-Nusra, the al-Qaeda branch in Syria. And of course, groups like ISIS are totally off the table. So finding an acceptable opposition, if you just get the opposition that the Russians want or that the Syrian government is willing to negotiate with, you have very little legitimacy amongst those Syrian opposition who have been fighting and dying for almost 5 years now. You know, that's a very small portion of the opposition. The crux of any political settlement depends on whether or not you can get the Syrian government to agree to concessions that are constitutionally encoded without caveat that can satisfy at least the minimum demands of a critical mass of the opposition. I just don't think there's any way right now that the Vienna talks and the lists that people are drawing up are going to come up with a critical mass of the opposition who can bring enough of the opposition to the table, particularly, you know, via a ceasefire, which seems to be what everyone's working for before you even get to, you know, the many issues that divide Syrians today. But can you get enough of them to the table at all? And I don't think you can right now.
How can the West and Russia come to an agreement on the opposition?
Well, it's going to be a lot of horse trading. Each side at some point have to make concessions with regard to who they deem the acceptable opposition, acceptable in terms of being an opposition group with whom the Syrian government could agree to negotiate with. Right now, the Syrian government, basically anybody that's fighting it, is a terrorist group. And Russia has, and to a certain degree Iran, has adopted that same definition. So the Russians and the Syrian government and the Iranians, and particularly the Russians and Iranians, probably will have to put pressure on the Syrian government to open the net wider in terms of who is an acceptable opposition. And I think the West will as well. I think the United States and European countries will have to accept certain armed Islamist opposition groups that aren't Jabhat al-Nusra, that aren't ISIS, as negotiating partners, or else you're just not going to reach that critical mass.
David, there appears to be a Russian proposal that is being circulated that calls for drafting a new constitution within 18 months. Put to a popular referendum, followed by early presidential elections, but it makes no mention of President Bashar al-Assad stepping down during any transition period. What do you make of that?
They're trying, I think, the Russians to, through early elections, bring some legitimacy to Bashar al-Assad. And, of course, many in the West and many players in the region, you know, want to see quite the opposite.
That's David Lesh of Trinity University in Texas. He says the burden is on Damascus to state what political reforms it's prepared to discuss, including amendments to the Constitution. That, he says, must be preceded by a ceasefire. Meanwhile, Lesh suspects Russia is disappointed that its military intervention has not translated into more victories by the Syrian army backed by Iran and Hezbollah. He says opposition forces faced with Russian airstrikes have stiffened their resolve and received more assistance from Gulf Arab states. Well, looking at social media, the New York Times reports that Kurdish forces began an offensive early Thursday to retake Mount Sinjar in northern Iraq and another town from the Islamic State. The militants seized the territory last year and killed, abused, and enslaved thousands of Yazidis. According to the Times, U.S.-led air forces bombed the area before the offensive. The mission wants also to stop a major supply line for IS between Syria and the Iraqi city of Mosul. Reuters reports that at least 100 soldiers and fighters were killed in northern Syria in fighting earlier this week as Syrian government forces reached an airbase held by the Islamic State. It says most of those killed were IS militants. And Euronews reports that Jordan's King Abdullah says his country is maxed out by providing asylum to Syrian refugees. He says his country has taken in roughly 1.4 million Syrian refugees. That's about 20% of Jordan's population. And that's a look at social media. Amnesty International says Chinese police are still routinely using torture to extract confessions from criminal suspects. I'm speaking now with Amnesty International's China researcher, Patrick Poon. Patrick, what kind of torture are you talking about in this respect?
In our report, actually, we highlight that in Chinese law, in fact, only they touch on the issue of extracting confession and using violence to obtain evidence. I mean, like, it's actually not enough to just to include these two areas, because in many of those cases we also highlighted in the report, we talked to lawyers and actually also academics. What we find out is that to those people, especially dissidents, human rights defenders, Falun Gong petitioners, religious believers, and even like corrupt officials, they can also be subject to torture when they detain. For example, like for corrupt officials, if they are under the party disciplinary action, Zhuangwei, the double registration, and during the investigation by the procuratorate, the prosecutors, they can also be subject to torture, as we all heard from lawyers who handle cases like that. So that happens to also to other human rights defenders. They handle the case, the lawyers handle those cases. And very often, even the human rights lawyers themselves would be subject to torture and ill treatment. And like, for example, in the case of Yi Wen-shen, Beijing lawyer, after he put something online last year supporting the Hong Kong protests, and he was detained for 99 days. And during those 99 days, he was subject to a long period of interrogations for up to 200 times, as he told us. And every time for several hours, with like this kind of prolonged interrogation. So you can see like actually lawyers themselves would even be subject to this kind of torture. It's just not difficult to imagine is to see how ordinary people would be subject to various kinds of torture in detention.
Another thing that is used is an area called a use of something called a black jail, where people are taken to sort of a secret location.
Yeah, exactly. Like for black jail is a kind of arbitrary detention in China, and there's no law in China to prohibit that. While this actually in practice, what we hear from lawyers are quite rampant among human rights defenders, petitioners, long-term petitioners, Falun Gong petitioners, religious believers, etc. So all these people actually would be detained in places, in unknown places, for example, even like in hotels, guest house, or even in abandoned flats or in underground rooms. So it's actually very dangerous and very risky for them to be detained in such locations, because it would expose them to higher risk of torture, while actually nobody can find them because these bad jail locations are actually unknown to many people. When these people are detained, they don't have any access to lawyers and their family, so it exposed them to even more risk of torture.
Well, this report comes out as the United Nations is scheduled to conduct a regular review of China's record on torture. How do you expect the UN, you know, how would you like the UN to receive the information that you've compiled in this report?
We have already sent copies of our submission and also this report to the UN. And then as this committee, the Committee Against Torture in the past, also make very strong comments on China in the past. Like last time, 7 years ago in 2008, they also make a lot of strong comments and press the Chinese government to improve different areas concerning torture. So we would also expect this time that the committee would also make very strong comments on China. And the Chinese government actually has not been responding directly and positively to all the questions raised by the committee so far. So at the hearing, we will also be attending the hearing to monitor how the Chinese government will respond to the committee's further questions and comments on the Chinese government's human rights record and torture record.
Thanks very much. That's Patrick Poon. He's China researcher at Amnesty International in Hong Kong. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Paleontologists have discovered a giant, ancient, and feathered relative of today's birds. Called the Dakota Raptor, this new species is the big cousin of the Velociraptor, which was made famous in the Jurassic Park movies. The researchers who made the discovery of this ancient predator say that the creature is the largest specimen ever found with wing feathers. The giant raptor is thought to have been a little over 5 meters long, which would make it one of the largest raptors in the world. The creature lived about 65 million years ago during the Cretaceous period. The researchers say that this predatory dinosaur was lightly built and probably just as agile as their cousin, the brutal but smaller Velociraptor. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new documentary looks at the life of football star Ronaldo. White and Asian students in the United States continue to outperform their Black and Latin counterparts nationwide. That's the conclusion of a U.S. Department of Education 2015 report card assessing nationwide student achievement. Elizabeth Lee examines some of the causes of this persistent gap from Los Angeles, one of the most diverse cities in the country.
Negative infinity and guess what, right?
High school students Robin Choi and Jewel Prim share one key ingredient that makes them academically successful.
Ever since I can remember, college has never been a choice. It's something that's essential.
Well, my parents have always told me since I was a child that education was an investment to my career.
It's based on sales, no.
Both students attend Harvard Teacher Preparation Academy, a school that gives them as much support as they get at home. But not every school presents this type of experience. English teacher Natalie Collier says if students do not get basic academic skills by the time they reach high school, many of them become disinterested, and that is just one challenge.
The lack of motivation also comes from outside the environment. If most of the critical mass is not focused on education, then I believe it kind of trickles down and that becomes the influence.
Latino and Black students are most affected by socioeconomic challenges that keep them from excelling when compared to their white and Asian counterparts, says the University of California, Los Angeles education professor Marcelo Suarez Orozco.
Both Latino children and African American children are once again attending schools that are highly segregated. They're highly segregated by race, by poverty, by language, by legal status.
all factors that contribute to an achievement gap that continues into college, says Ken O'Donnell, California State University's Senior Director of Student Engagement.
If you're the first in your generation to come to college, then that's a strike against you. We have to work harder to keep those people in school because the support networks aren't in place.
O'Donnell says the achievement gap can have lasting repercussions.
The students who come to us underprepared are likelier to drop out and likelier to take longer to graduate. And so for their life outcomes after graduation, in terms of lifetime earnings, happiness, health outcomes, all those benefits that come with earning a degree, for them are delayed by at least several years and may not happen at all.
So when we're looking at places...
At Harvard Teacher Preparation Academy, teachers begin talking about college as soon as the students start high school. They try to empower the students and provide a personalized approach to teaching, says Principal Jan Marotta.
Unless you reach that child and show that you care and get the students there and believe in them, then it makes it really difficult.
For many of today's teachers, UCLA's Suarez Orozco says reaching students means being sensitive to the cultural, linguistic, and economic barriers they face.
So knowing your students, knowing where they're coming from, knowing their communities.
But influences and responsibilities outside the classroom may continue to cause an achievement gap among Black and Hispanic students in many schools. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Los Angeles.
This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. He's won the FIFA Player of the Year award three times. He's won the Golden Boot as European soccer's top scorer four times. He has legions of adoring fans. And now a new documentary looks at his life off the field. International Edition's David Byrd tells us about the film Ronaldo, which looks at the life of Portuguese national and Real Madrid star Cristiano Ronaldo.
There's no arguing with Cristiano Ronaldo's skills on the football field. This year, the 30-year-old became Real Madrid's all-time leading scorer with 324 career goals. He scored 48 goals in 35 Spanish League games to win the Golden Boot for the fourth time. No other player has four of the scoring awards. He has won the Golden Ball as FIFA's Player of the Year three times and is nominated for a fourth trophy this year. But in a new documentary, Ronaldo, director Anthony Fonca takes fans behind the public sportsman to give us a glimpse of Ronaldo's life off the field. The documentary combines archival highlights with film shot over 14 months to give a look at the football star's life, particularly with his family. Cristiano Ronaldo says that he was able to relax in front of the camera, and it shows in the movie.
When I speak with the guys from Universal, they plan to do it like 3 days of filming, but I'm just feeling so comfortable and good chemistry with the director and Anthony and Paul that the thing is coming in a natural way. So in the movie that you're going to have opportunity to see that we have very intense moments, very private moments, because I was enjoying to do it, the filming. So I think the last result, I think it's great. You're going to have opportunity to see it. It was unbelievable.
Director Anthony Fonca says that he was surprised by the quiet life that one of the world's top football players lives off the field.
He lives actually a relatively, you know, strict life. You know, comes home and trains and sleeps and does that. It's no mad partying, or, you know, it's and so that was a surprise. His ability to deal with pressure is actually, that's fascinating. You know, he has this, he loves it, you know, and he thrives on it. And that was for me was fascinating.
Winning, that's the most important to me. It's as simple as that.
Ronaldo's agent Jorge Mendes said at the London premiere that the film gives fans a chance to know Cristiano the man instead of Cristiano the football star.
I think that now we have a chance to know better Cristiano. And almost of the people, I think that you don't know really who is Cristiano. Everybody knows Cristiano as a player, but as a father and out of the pitch is really, I think that you should see the movie.
Nothing is impossible, my friend.
I have what I have because I sacrifice a lot.
Tudo que tenho, dedico ao futebol.
Some people hate me. Some people love me. Fui feito para ser o melhor.
Ronaldo is produced by the same team that released documentaries on Formula One racing champion, the late Ayrton Senna of Brazil, and the late British pop singer Amy Winehouse. It is rated PG-13 and is in theaters now. I'm David Byrd in Washington.
And that's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks so much for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
U.S. Deputy National Security Advisor Benjamin Rhodes announced on October 16th $2.2 million in new U.S. support for Laos National Mine Clearance Operator, UXO's Lao, which will enable it to rehire trained technicians it lost in 2014 as a result of funding difficulties. The UXO Lao teams will be deployed in Wampan, Sing Quang, Quan Mon, Savanakhet, Salavan, and Champasak provinces. Mr. Rhodes said that the United States is committed to helping Laos clear unexploded ordnance, or UXO, contaminated areas in order to reduce casualties and to increase the productivity of agricultural lands to reduce poverty. Mr. Rhodes recently visited a UXO Lao team clearing unexploded ordnance from Bonpaku village in Luang Prabang province. The UXO Lao team briefed Mr. Rhodes on its progress in the village and described the training that the team members must undertake in order to work in this sector. Mr. Rhodes said that he was impressed by the UXO Lao team's commitment to this work, which is so important for the Lao people and especially for the younger generation. With the new contribution, the United States will have provided more than $100 million in mine action and UXO-related assistance to Laos. Priority funding will support clearance of UXO found as a result of evidence-based survey, a cutting-edge technique that identifies contaminated areas more effectively and efficiently than ever before. Victims assistance programs will provide direct services to survivors of unexploded ordnance accidents and their families and help strengthen first aid and emergency response of key health facilities and village volunteers in heavily impacted provinces. Funding for risk awareness supports education of Lao citizens, especially children, about the dangers of UXO. USAID's Leahy War Victims Fund provided funding to the Cooperative Orthotic Prosthetic Enterprise to support physical rehabilitation programs, including prosthetics, orthotics, and mobility aids to nearly 4,500 people, including 1,500 children. The United States is proud to work with Laos and its non-governmental partners to free the people of Laos from the threat of landmines, unexploded ordnance, and other deadly remnants of war.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.